KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for the Fish Report here on KSDP. Let's start out with the numbers for the Alaska Peninsula, as well as our first harvest summary for the Chinook Management Area. And some escapement. No new numbers in Bristol Bay, though, and we don't have anything from Kodiak either. But starting out with the numbers for the Alaska Peninsula, there was a total of 71,000 sockeye harvested across the region yesterday, for a total now just shy of 400,000 through June 21st, 2025. 11,000 pink salmon were also harvested, for a total of 62,000, and 13,000 chum, for a total of 98,000. Breaking it by area, the June Chumgan Island area had 14,000 sockeye delivered yesterday, just shy of 70,000 to date. 5,000 pink salmon delivered in the Chumgans yesterday for a total of 17,000, and 7,000 chum for a total now of 22,000. South Unimak area had 17,000 sockeye delivered yesterday for a total of 262,000, 6,000 pinks for a total of 44,000, and 4,000 chum for a total of 74,000. More action on the North Peninsula. The Northwestern District was open for the first time this year. They're at 6,500 sockeye so far and 1,800 chum salmon. Nelson Lagoon had 3,000 fish up the weir there for a total of 23,000. And Port Mueller to Outer Port Hyden had 31,000 yesterday for sockeye for a grand total now of 35,000. Moving over to the Chinook Harvest Report. Yesterday was 16,000 sockeye delivered for a total now of 16,000 sockeye, and that was totally in the Chinook Bay area. The Central District doesn't have any numbers as it is confidential. Eastern, Western, and Perryville reported no sockeye harvested, so a total now harvest of 16,000 in the Chinook Management Area. Looking across the Alaska Peninsula for escapement, 20,000 sockeye went up the weir yesterday in Chinook. They're at 140,000 to date, and that's really catching up to 2016 now at this point. Nelson River, 14,000 fish up the weir yesterday for a grand total of 61,000. And that is six times more than the next closest year. 2023 had 11,000. So almost six times more than the next biggest year in the last 10. So a little bit of an unprecedented escapement in Nelson. 2,000 in the Bear River for a total of just under 12,000 to date. And again, that's kind of the midpoint for them. Ilinik, 400 fish up the weir. They're at 15,000, another midpoint year, but looking pretty healthy. And then Orzinski with 30 fish up the weir for a total now of 455 to date. 2016, this time they had 276 fish, but still the best in the last 10 for the Orzinski system. Ilyuk was flooded. They're at 23 fish to date. Bristol Bay harvest, again, nothing new for the Bristol Bay management area as of yesterday, the 21st. They're still reporting 350,000 sockeye delivered so far to date. Looking back on June the 20th of 2024, this time last year, the Bristol Bay area was reporting only 42,000 fish, so they're ahead of this time last year. That will do it for the Fish Report here on KSDP. This report is brought to you by Eastern Aleutian Tribes. Stay tuned for more great content and programming coming up right now on KSDP.
Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Freedom of the press is something that we should all care about. Readers can make choices. Do they want to support hedge fund-owned newspapers and news sites, or do they want to support digital startups that have tried to fill the void? You have to fight for your freedoms, and you have to fight to preserve your rights. Freedom of the press is not something that you should take for granted. Our democracy is at stake.
The most critical feedback loop in a free society is a free press. In this episode, we hear from three journalists innovating to revive local news outlets against the onslaught of predatory market forces that leave news deserts in their wake. With Larry Rickman, publisher and co-founder of the Colorado Sun, Madeline Baer, founder of El Timpano, and Jacob Seamus, community journalism director for the Cityside Journalism Initiative. I'm your host, Neil Harvey. This is When No News Is Bad News, the struggle to save local journalism. As the iconic journalist Bill Moyers has said, the quality of journalism and the quality of democracy are inextricably intertwined. Yet decades of corporate consolidation in the U.S. allowed a half dozen giant conglomerates to seize control of information and nearly annihilate critical local news outlets that people rely on and trust. Two or more local newspapers go out of business every week. In just the past 20 years, nearly a third have folded under the crushing weight of giant media and digital platform monopolies that starve them of advertising revenues. Some outlets that survive become distressed properties and therefore targets for private equity firms that swoop in, downsize them, strip them for parts, and then close up shop. According to a 2025 study by Northwestern's Medill Journalism School, about a fifth of people in the U.S. live with little or no access to local news, and they often live in rural and low-income areas. One committed journalist who decided to fight back is Larry Rickman. After decades working as a reporter for the Associated Press, he landed at the Pulitzer Prize-winning Denver Post. Ironically, he'd previously worked as a foreign correspondent in the early 90s, where he covered the dismantling and looting of the Soviet Union by big banks and investors. Returning to the U.S., he witnessed the Alden Capital Hedge Fund dismantling and looting the Post. Larry Rickman spoke at a Bioneers conference.
Alden is a hedge fund that buys distressed properties, whether they're shoe stores or pharmacies or whatever it might be. I mean, you know, back in the day, owning a newspaper was like printing money. It was a very profitable business until it wasn't. Craigslist came along, the internet came along, digital advertising, print advertising became upended, and it became a very different business. And when the bills came due, the people who held the notes were hedge funds like Alden Global Capital. So Alden went from not being involved in newspapers at all to being one of the nation's largest newspaper owners. It's just been awful to see them snap up newspapers left and right and do what they do. So they follow a very similar playbook in town after town after town. They come in and they buy the newspaper. They sell off the real estate. So that might be the newspaper's building, might be the printing press, whatever that property might be. So they sell off the real estate, they jack up subscription costs, and they cut the staff. So they just lay people off, wave after wave after wave of relentless cutting. And there's another hedge fund that owns the nation's largest newspaper group, which is Gannett. Take a look at Salinas, California, birthplace of John Steinbeck. The Salinas Californian was once a great scrappy newspaper that covered Salinas. Today, Gannett owns it. They have no local reporters left. They've laid off all the reporters. The only unique local content in the Salinas Californian are death notices. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. And that's what the future looks like under hedge fund ownership. They are not planning for the future. It's all about today. So they squeeze every dime they can out of these properties. And at the end, if nobody wants to subscribe to it, they've already made their money and they move on. And they just turn the lights out. They really do not care at all about newspapers, journalists, or these communities, or frankly, democracy itself. These hedge funds are such a threat. I think that they have done more damage to American democracy than practically anything that I can even think about. I mean, how can we expect to have informed voters if people don't have access to knowledge, if they don't have access to, you know, verified information? There's a reason the founding fathers put protection for freedom of the press in the very first amendment to the Constitution. It wasn't that they were any big fans of newspapers. They got beat up pretty bad back in their day. Maybe they should have gotten beat up a little more, but they understood that a healthy democracy depends on a vibrant free press. It depends on having a watchdog able to ask difficult questions of those in power.
Powerful political and economic players benefit from information deserts. Research shows what happens when communities don't have reliable local news sources. There's more corruption and higher public spending. Fewer people register and turn out to vote. Fewer people run for office. And there's more polarization. Research also shows that good local journalism holds policymakers to account. Communities that are well-informed are more likely to have representatives that vote in their interests. But since 2005, a whopping three-quarters of newspaper jobs have been axed. Newspaper job losses now rank in the same range as employees of companies that manufacture DVDs and cassette tapes. Rickman says that when we have fewer reporters, it's the community that loses.
We've lost so much. I mean, the fact is it's sad when anyone loses their job, whether it's a journalist or someone working in a restaurant or a factory. The tragedy is we'll never know the stories that aren't being told because there wasn't a journalist there to tell them. The trials that weren't covered, the city council meetings that weren't covered, the school board meetings that weren't covered because there wasn't a journalist left to cover them. Once upon a time, legacy newspapers like the Denver Post had teams of reporters who covered City Hall, teams of reporters who covered state government, who covered religion, education, health, etc. Those are long gone. Where are people left to turn for news about their government? You know, the fact is there are bad people getting away with things because there was no journalist there to, you know, shed light on their misdeeds. But also, you know, journalism is not just about being the watchdog. It's also about celebrating good people doing good things in our communities. And journalism provides the fabric that weaves together the tapestry of community. It helps us connect with each other. I've heard from people in the arts community that they've noticed the absence of journalism as well. They've said, we don't care if we even get a bad review for our production. If there's no review, people don't come to our art galleries or they don't come to our productions. When there is a lack of local news coverage, what do you have left? It is more of the national discussion. It's the news coming out of Washington. It just dominates everything. It's the politics, things coming in from TV, from wire services, whatever it is. If the hedge funds and others aren't willing to hire local reporters, they're filling up their newspapers with something. It's not things that are relevant to you and me on a local level.
When Alden Capital Hedge Fund bought the Denver Post, it ordered Larry Rickman and his fellow journalists to vacate their offices in the iconic downtown Denver Post building and exiled them to the printing plant in the suburbs. A few weeks later, Alden Capital cut another third of the newsroom. That's when Rickman decided there must be a better way. He invited 9 other journalists from the Denver Post, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters, to start a new online news outlet. The Colorado Sun would explore new models for journalism.
Journalism isn't dying, but the old business models are dying. Newspapers forever, 100-plus years, were dependent largely upon advertising. Yes, you had to pay for a subscription, but circulation never paid the bills for a newsroom, really, and newspapers could provide that because there was no internet. There was no other way to get their message out there other than advertising in the newspapers or maybe going on radio or TV. So that model is dying right before our eyes. Now, the Colorado Sun, when we launched in September of 2018, we looked around and said, you know, if the old model was built around traditional advertising, then let's not do that. Let's come up with another way. And in the newspaper world, in the legacy newspaper world, and I'm talking digital here, the way you get eyeballs is through page views. The way you get page views is to do things like write about zoo babies. You know, when there's a new baby at the zoo, and for the record, I love zoo babies. But those stories are easy to do, and they're cheap to do, because you'll get a press release, you can rewrite it in less than a half an hour, you post some photos, and then you move on. But does that really provide us much understanding of what's going on in the world? It doesn't. You know, what takes time is to file public records requests, to sit through court hearings or sit through government hearings. Who's got time to do that if not a journalist? Most people don't. So we go there and try to do that work because it's important to do. But, you know, a lot of news organizations are just stretched so thin that their reporters don't have time to go out and actually, you know, get out in the world and talk to real people and dig into documents and do the kind of traditional work that needs to be done. You know, I look around the country and it's not just the Colorado Sun that has popped up, but there are, you know, things here in the Bay Area, Berkeley side, Oakland side, Cal Matters, things that have popped up to try to fill the void.
When we return, Larry Rickman joins two fellow news entrepreneurs innovating new models of journalism. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. You can explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online, and learn about the National Bioneers Conference at bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. As local news outlets are shuttered week after week, new models of news media are crystallizing to fill the void. Today, there are nearly 500 nonprofit news organizations reporting for their communities. It's clear there's no lack of heart, grit, and reporting chops to provide vital local news. The question is how to pay for it when federal funding for public media has been slashed since the Reagan administration declared war on it in the 1980s. Those grants continue to diminish today. Some state governments have passed legislation to support local newsrooms. It includes subsidies, tax credits, and journalism fellowships to retain and hire reporters. Philanthropy has also stepped up with hundreds of millions of dollars, but it's far from enough to stem the losses. Some outlets are funded solely by their readers. One emerging nonprofit model revolves around building trust by listening to and reporting on the local community's perceived needs and aspirations. Building that cohesion also helps outlets engage more effectively with city, county, and state governments. Madeline Baer is an award-winning journalist and the founder of El Tímpano, a media outlet which creates news stories for and with Spanish and Mayan-speaking residents in the San Francisco Bay Area.
So I started El Tímpano back in 2018, and before launching, we undertook a process of just listening for nearly a year to Spanish and indigenous Mayan immigrants in Oakland to really hear what do they want to see in local media? What are the issues that are most important to them? Where do they get news and information on those issues? What do they want to see change in local media? And what's really interesting is when you start from that place rather than from the idea that, well, we'll start putting up Spanish language articles on a website, you wind up with a very different looking newsroom. And in that initial listening process, we heard from so many people that I don't have a home computer, I don't have home internet, I wish I could get the news on my phone or at any time of day. And so text messaging became our primary platform for distribution and also engagement. But we're also in the streets. We do a lot of community outreach and engagement. We partner with a lot of other trusted organizations because all of our work is really founded on a relationship of trust with the audiences, the communities that we serve. We have a editorial meeting each week where rather than us looking at what other news outlets are covering or what sort of press releases are coming in, we're really listening to the community members themselves and talking about, okay, what are the stories that came in that week from our text messaging community? What stories are worth investigating? Also looking back at all of the surveying we've done, which has told us, for instance, you know, a lot of people might think that as a news outlet covering immigrant communities, immigration might be the number one issue. Not true. Immigration is actually usually around number five. The top issue of concern for the communities we cover is health. Has been well before the pandemic and is every time we go out and ask people. And so that's why the very first reporter that we hired is a health equity reporter, and that's most of what you'll see on our website.
Journalist and educator Jacob Seamus is the community journalism director for the Cityside Journalism Initiative. It's a media outlet that creates hyper-local news stories in Berkeley, Oakland, and Richmond, California.
We also started a pretty in-depth community listening campaign to just really try to understand what people in Oakland wanted. And so we really saw this absence of like a lot of the bread and butter stuff that local newspapers used to provide, you know, information about local community events, consistent reporting about public meetings, you know, what's happening at the school board, what's happening with the city council. You know, we have a section that we call How We Work. And it's just a space where, as editors and reporters, we can just explain to readers why we do journalism the way we do, why we don't cover crime the way that the Oakland Trib used to, why instead we chose to cover the police department and cover systems instead of symptoms, right? That kind of work, I think, has been really important in building trust with our communities in Oakland. It's just so important that local news plays such a critical role of like a town square where people can have conversations and dig into the nuance without the polarization that you get at the national level with discourse and that's playing out in certain platforms.
By listening to their readers, news outlets like El Tímpano and Cityside can produce life-saving information for the communities they serve. That includes community feedback on what's not working the way it's supposed to.
California became the first state in the nation to expand Medi-Cal eligibility to undocumented immigrants of all ages. Really groundbreaking policy to address a huge health equity issue. You know, these are the communities that El Tímpano is really designed to serve. And so we've been following this policy for years. It's kind of come out in stages. So when they expanded to include undocumented immigrants 50 years and up last year, we informed our community members, told them how to sign up, what the eligibility requirements are, where to call if they want to learn more. For thousands of undocumented immigrants, they were newly eligible, newly enrolled, and really trying to access their healthcare coverage for the very first time. We found a number of these community members within El Tímpano's own audience. As we were providing information about this expanded new policy, so many people were writing us back saying, actually, I've been trying to get back onto Medi-Cal for months, but no one will answer my call. Or I was dropped from Medi-Cal and I can't figure out why. It seems to be a mistake. That's one example of why this method of really having a two-way conversation with our audience is so critical, because we could just provide this information about this, you know, great new policy, how you can access it. But whenever we do that and invite community members to write back, we hear, lo and behold, that policy usually isn't working as it's intended. So we want to cover, you know, the successes of policies like that, but also what are the challenges that they're facing.
The Bay Area's Cityside publishes community input and actually pays community members to contribute stories. Again, Jacob Seamus.
We're not the first publisher to run first-person stories, but we do it with a lot of deliberation and consistency, where we will find community members with important lived experiences to share, and we'll invite them to either write a piece or allow us to listen to their story and then transcribe it into a piece that we can publish, and we pay them a commission, the same as we would pay a freelance reporter. Some of those stories have been wildly popular. You know, a few that come to mind would be a mother who lost a son and multiple family members to gun violence, and getting that really nuanced take on the problem of gun violence in Oakland. Also from a solutions angle, because she's now doing incredible violence prevention work for an organization in the community. We partnered with El Tímpano on some of this work to produce some really impactful stories of folks in the local immigrant community struggling to find housing during the pandemic. So many really great examples, but that's one I wanted to point out.
New models of journalism range from an approach of community engagement and outreach to creative ways to sustain the small outlets that remain. Surprisingly, some of these new models are reviving the earliest form of news media, print journalism.
We have two housing reporters at Cityside. They would get all these appeals from people in the community, emails, phone calls from folks asking them, as experts in their beat and in their field, asking them about resource information and like, how do I get on this list for this housing in my community? They just realized like, hey, you know, there's an incredible need for like a one-stop shop for just information that people can use about affordable housing in the East Bay. They came to their editors and say, hey, we want to take this on and we want to create this affordable housing guide. And we don't want to just put it on the website because a lot of people are going to miss it. We actually want to create a physical product and distribute that in the community and make it available to people. So we piloted that and we did it. They did an incredible job. It was a bunch of reporting and like multiple articles, but then also just a lot of resource information that they pulled out of their reporting, what people need to know to access affordable housing in Berkeley and Oakland, and put that content into a print publication. We printed 500 of those because we were taking baby steps and we thought, okay, let's just kind of see if there's an appetite for this, right? And brought it to some places in the community and some different community providers and libraries and things of that nature. Published the whole package online, made it available as a PDF download, and left an email for people to get a hold of us if they wanted us to actually bring them a copy of the print version. And we ended up producing 5,000 because of the outpouring of messages that we received from people asking for that information, both people in personal situations where they wanted the information, but also from service providers who saw a benefit in what we produced and the way we produced it. It was very easy to understand and access. So yeah, it's a cost, but it sure seems worth it.
So when I left the Denver Post and we launched the Colorado Sun as an all-digital news organization, it was liberating, right? No more print limitations, didn't have to worry about the cost of newsprint or any of those kinds of things.
Again, Larry Rickman.
And we were just, you know, going along and growing at the Sun. And then the phone rang one day and somebody said, you know, have you ever thought about owning a group of newspapers? I'm like, no, I have not. Should I? And the answer was, yes, I should. A lot of newspapers, small newspapers, particularly in rural areas, are owned by mom and pop operations. And that was the case with these 24 suburban Denver newspapers. So we partnered up with the National Trust for Local News, which is a nonprofit, national nonprofit, and we jointly bought these 24 print newspapers. The good news is, more than 2 years later, those community newspapers are still doing their hyperlocal coverage, which is awesome. As it turned out, you spend most of your money at a newspaper on two things. People, of course, in your newsroom. Newsprint is the other thing. Newsprint prices have just gone up like crazy over the past few years. You know, newsprint manufacturers, frankly, make more money creating Amazon boxes than they do creating newsprint. So there are very few suppliers of newsprint. The place where we printed those community newspapers was up in Cheyenne, Wyoming. They wanted to more than double the cost of printing those newspapers. So we moved the printing to the Pueblo Chieftain, which is owned by Gannett. Well, not long after Gannett decided they were going to close the printing plant. So we ended up having to be printed at the Denver Post. So, you know, there's just no escape. So we, along with the National Trust for Local News and the Colorado Media Project, decided, you know what? What if we bought a printing press? What would that look like? And could we turn it into an asset for the community, for all of these other newspapers? It's counterintuitive, like, hey, I know a great business model. Let's get into print. But as it turns out, it really, you know, when you run the numbers, it made sense. I'm still, you know, happy about being all digital at the Sun because it's a lot less complicated. We don't have to worry about the availability of newsprint. But there's an equity issue as well. There are communities in Colorado, particularly rural communities, where their internet coverage is not great. They need print. They want print.
As established and emergent news outlets continue to research and reveal vital information for their communities, one way or the other, they require support. Clearly, good government policy ought to include support for journalism in a nation where the value of a free press is baked into the Constitution. At the same time, the reality on the ground is that communities themselves have a big stake in supporting local media and real news.
Freedom of the press is something that we should all care about. Readers can make choices. Do they want to support hedge fund-owned newspapers and news sites, or do they want to support digital startups that have tried to fill the void? You have to fight for your freedoms, and you have to fight to preserve your rights. Freedom of the press is not something that you should take for granted. You know, whether it's a hedge fund taking it away or whether it's the government, we all need access to information and knowledge. I'm up on my soapbox, but I'm not dramatizing this. Our democracy is at stake. And it's not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. I think it requires vigilance on all of our parts.
Larry Rickman, Madeline Baer, and Jacob Seamus. When no news is bad news. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Claire Reynolds and Kenny Ossibel. Producer, Claire Reynolds. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Associate producer, Emily Harris. Producer, Teo Grossman. Interview recording engineer was Rod Akeel at KPFA Studios. Production assistance by Caleb Wenzel Fisher. And I'm host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 281.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
John the Baptist and I had an odd relationship in primary school. Because of my failure to grasp the purpose of the Father, the little sign that tells you to lengthen a vowel in Irish, I found it hard to distinguish between words such as boshtuch, rain, and bashtia, baptism. Most 10-year-olds growing up in Dublin would take this phonological confusion in their stride, but my circumstances were different. My old primary school, Belgrove National School, was known in Irish as Scoil Ón Baistea, the school of John the Baptist, for the very good reason that it's located in the parish of St. John the Baptist. For me, the closeness of the two words boshtuch and baistea meant my child's imagination conjured up a version of John, who, despite spending much of his time in the desert, was somehow a permanently rain-sodden, bedraggled figure. I imagined him alone, crying in the wilderness, glumly preparing a meal of locusts and honey, while his own personal rain-laden cloud hovered close overhead in an otherwise blue sky. Other details of his story also caught my imagination. I felt for his aging parents, who'd given up hope of ever having a child. I was intrigued by how the babe leapt in Elizabeth's womb when Mary came to visit. I was puzzled by his relationship with his distant cousin Jesus and his self-effacing announcement that he wasn't worthy to untie Jesus' sandals. I certainly didn't feel like that about any of my cousins. My heart went out to him. There, I felt, was a man who hadn't had a fair crack at the whip. There was a man who, if he were alive now, would benefit from an assertiveness course. Years ago, when I started spending time in the west of Ireland, I realised that perhaps I wasn't alone in feeling he had been undervalued. I discovered that St. John's Eve, the 23rd of June, was a special date in the Connemara calendar. It was the custom, I was told, in parts of Connemara and elsewhere, to light bonfires on hilltops and headlands. While I suspected that this practice was more likely to be related to pagan celebrations of the summer solstice, I had enough affection for the old faith to want to persuade myself that these bonfires were part of a nationwide programme to grant a saintly man a little bit of the recognition he had shunned during his life. One summer, more than 30 years ago, my neighbour near Roundstone told me that he'd been assembling materials for a bonfire at Crookon an Tuairim. It was years since he had lit a bonfire. It was going to be a big bonfire, he said with pride, and I should come along. Even though I knew well that Sean's first language was Irish, I did the unforgivable and took the opportunity to correct his pronunciation. Do you mean bonfire, Sean? He didn't bat an eyelid. Well, it's Tina Crov in Irish, so there must be a bone in there somewhere. Unlike my manners, his etymology was beyond reproach. I learned later that bones were indeed frequently placed in bonfires, St. John's Eve bonfires and others, hence the term. When I joined him at his bonfire on Crookon an Tuairim, he was alone, drinking from a can of beer. He reminisced about how in the old days people would say prayers around the fire. There would be music and singing. The young men would vie with one another to jump back and forth through the flames. Cattle would be driven through the dying embers to ward off disease, and the embers would then be placed in a corner of a field to help the crops. He wasn't sure if he believed in any of that now. He was just doing it for old time's sake. Nobody else was bothered. Sure, this might be my last. It was his last. He died a few years later without ever setting another bonfire. St. John's Eve belonged to the old times, like so much else in his life. His strength as a curragh rower counted for nothing now that everyone had an outboard motor. His skill as a set dancer, of no value now that everyone preferred television. Last year, St. John's Eve, around 7 in the evening, I stood near the southern tip of Inishnee and checked the coastline from Glinsk to Letterard with binoculars for signs of a bonfire. I could see nothing. I walked up the hill at Kinraver to get a better look. I thought I could see a plume of smoke a few miles to the south, near Half Mace, but that was all. A poor showing. Sean was right. Nobody was bothered. A few hours later, I decided to head out again and climbed another hill that affords an almost uninterrupted view of Roundstone, Errisbeg, and Bertraboy Bay. Although it was nearly 11 o'clock at night, it was still essentially daylight, bright enough for me to make out the colours of the fields in Letterard across the bay. As I reached the crest of the hill, I felt my heart lift as I counted 4 bonfires on Errisbeg, a gentle north wind blowing smoke out towards the sea. There was one over at Cashel, and a further 5 along the stretch from Glinsk to Carna. A particularly bright fire was burning furiously down near the shore, more than 2 miles away at Collamore. If Sean had been alive, he would have been able to see it easily from his favourite vantage point, just leaning in the doorway of his house in Kinraver. It was a beautiful sight, and it would have lifted his heart too. I thought to myself, fair play to John the Baptist.
I'm John the Baptist, and this is my friend Salome. And you can bet it's my head she wants, and love my heart only. If you see me smiling, you wonder why.
I keep a knitting caddy beside my side of the sofa. In this knitting caddy are not half-finished jumpers or the cast-on stitches of a pair of socks, but rather a jumble of books, words knitted together in novels, crocheted into short stories, or embroidered onto the pages of a poetry collection. Right now, my caddy contains a volume of essays from Irish writers, copies of the Irish language magazine Core, poetry collections in Irish and English, receipts from a shoe shop, and several notebooks. The knitting caddy also has two front pockets, probably intended for keeping spools of thread, embroidery needles, and thimbles. But I've stuffed pens and highlighters into one pocket because the best books should be written on. The other pocket has bookmarks. To be clear, I'm not a bookmark fundamentalist. I have been known to keep my place by dog-earing the page, by sticking a pencil in the book, using a receipt, an unopened antiseptic wipe, a tag from a pair of pyjamas, or, to the horror of book lovers everywhere, other books. However, in a life that involves so much reading, both for business and pleasure, bookmarks tend to accumulate. I take them out of the pocket and spread them like a hand of cards. A Victoria and Albert Museum bookmark that I got for my 29th birthday. A bookmark memento from a friend's recent wedding. The fancy magnetic ones that I picked up in Hodges Figgis in Dublin. These magnetic ones seem to me to be the no-nonsense operators of the bookmark world. They snap onto the page, tight as a kiss lock on a purse. You can throw the book haphazardly into a bag and be in no danger of losing your page. I imagine these bookmarks rolling their eyes at the flimsy paper Doolittles who fall asleep on the job and have to be fished out from the grit at the bottom of a rucksack. I've never been a fan of the elastic bookmark, however. Who wants a thick, stretchy band holding the page for you with all the tenderness of a wedgie? And other examples. A solemn, sword-bearing angel Raphael gazes up at me from the gilt bookmark I bought in Christchurch Cathedral. And I've got bookmarks that aren't bookmarks at all. A vintage postcard sent from Cork on the 30th of April 1911 with a picture of a cat on the front. All good wishes. I know you're fond of cats, says the script on the back, writ before my great-grandparents were born. There's also something special in buying owl books and finding the previous owner's impromptu bookmarks between the pages, musty and fine as pressed flowers. I opened my second-hand copy of An Duineach, Dineen's Irish Dictionary, and found numerous articles about Sean Lamass's economic policies, clipped out and stuck between various pages. I found reviews of the Patrick McGinley novel Goosefoot, which had been scissored out from the newspapers and slid between the pages of the novel itself. And multiple bookmarks from bookshops, Dubray, Eason's, Kenny's, and especially from Charlie Burns in Galway. I love it when the booksellers ring up the stack of books and then stick a bookmark or two into the pages, like your granny slipping a 50-euro note into a birthday card. And my Owlist bookmark, the one that says the most. A leather slab from the Ulster American Folk Park in Tyrone from a school tour when I was 10, back in 2005, back when you felt the need to scribble your name on everything. I slide it out of the book I am currently reading, Misha Raftery and Feodor Fuckel by Tadhg McConaghan. I flip the bookmark over and still discern Lucy Costello, 4th and 5th class, Murlough School. I've also written my old home phone number and, in case I got lost and needed to hand something over to a kind stranger to show where I lived, Calhame, Ballandrate, County Donegal. All of this in childish, round letters, parts of it written in blue marker that has bruised into the brown leather over the years. 10 years later, in 2015, I wrote the Irish version of my name, Leashach ní Chostila, in black biro as well, the letters slanting forward in confident Clo Gaelic, the Gaelic script. The elongated R shape of the S, the punk Shevihe over the C for the rasp of Chostila. 10 years later again, in 2025, I thumb the edges of my Eolus bookmark, trace over the letters of my two names. I take up Mishraftery again. I'm nearly finished. And I slot the bookmark back into its rightful place. I tidy up the bookmarks, slide them back into their pocket in the knitting caddy, and I get up from the sofa.
As the championship in hurling and football gets to the important stage, we've spent the last months packing the lunches and loading children into the car to head to a town somewhere in pursuit of All-Ireland glory. And even though the island has shrunk thanks to the motorways, it can still be quite a jaunt and still maybe involve an overnight stay to see your team in action. I recently headed off on a solo run to see Down play Clare in Ennis, Sunday afternoon match. A 4-hour trip for me. Family were all away for the weekend, so I decided to go on Saturday afternoon and stay over. Now, in the olden days, you'd have gone to the Bord Fáilte brochure, found a St Bernadette's or a Mount Carmel B&B with vacancies in the town, and rung up, spoken to a human being, and booked. Not now, of course. So I sat in the kitchen, opened the laptop, and went through the online accommodation options. Not much was available on that Saturday afternoon for that night, but one place immediately stood out, describing itself as a cabin in the woods. Sure, wouldn't a cabin in the woods be lovely? I thought, re-commune with nature and all that. But reading the listing more closely, I saw it was billed as a work in progress. A garden shed with bare wooden walls, bare wooden floor and a fold-up single bed on the edge of a forest, with no electricity or running water, and under facilities, the line that stood out to me was, there is a hole in the ground for the needful. Now, I was only looking for a bed for the night, but still in all, the hole in the ground for the needful was not on my bucket list. So I kept on scrolling. And I'm not fussy. I've stayed in some kips in my time, a split-level bungalow in Donegal, that was indeed split level in the sense that the top level was a house with no heating and the bottom level was a cow shed with lots of sleepy little flies that were so glad to see us. And then there was the night not that long ago in Derry when after a football match, a great night out and a green coat that went missing with the house keys in it, myself, my wife and my brother-in-law found ourselves sleeping the whole night in the car. Me in the driver's seat, wife in the passenger seat, and the brother-in-law stretched out in the back. And it's a funny feeling, bedding down in your car, parked outside your house, in your drive, at 2 a.m. on a cold night in the middle of winter, knowing that you're all going to be there for the next 7 hours. And so, up for whatever adventure might befall, that Saturday afternoon last month, I booked a room in a house, closed the laptop, and hit the road on my own with a song in my heart, podcasts and playlists and snacks for the journey, and sure, the time flew by. Arrived into Ennis about 8 on Saturday night, wandered round the town, maybe more American tourists than Down supporters there, grabbed a bite to eat and a pint, and off to bed for an early night. My room was less than ideal, I have to say. No lock on the door, a lingering smell of wet dog, and a pile of somebody else's clothes on the other single bed in the room. All part of the adventure, I know, but when the banattee asked what time I fancied breakfast in the morning, I politely declined and said, I'll get up early and get out and find somewhere myself. Thank you. Sunday morning dawned bright and sunny and warm, and I found myself listening to the radio, crawling behind slow-moving caravans and lycra-clad cyclists on the winding road through Ennistymon to Lahinch. Sure, I was in no hurry. Lahinch provided a memorable breakfast that filled me for the rest of the day. I took time to look out at the big sea and the Atlantic rollers sweeping in as the world passed by on the prom. Then out along the coast to Spanish Point, bathed in sunshine, looking very posh. Sunday Mass was on in Milltown Malby. A dog sauntered across the street in front of me and eyed me as if to say, I live here and you don't. Willie Clancy piping away silently on the main street. Miriam's talking to Simon Le Bon on the radio. And all the time, I've one eye out to see, would Sharon Shannon or Davy Spillane or Marty Morrissey or Stockton's Wing just happen to be coming out of the local shop with Maura O'Connell and a bag of sausages and black pudding for the breakfast. Vogue Williams is having a great chat with Brenton O'Connor as I roll back into Ennis in good time and get parked 5 minutes from the pitch. And I make sure to follow an ancient tradition of, even though there's hardly anybody at the match, making sure the car is pointed for home. Not my first rodeo. And I head in for the big match. It's been a long 6 months since the start of the year. I got a tan in Ennis, I got a soaking in Enniskillen, and I've spent many happy Saturday evenings in Park Essler in Newry. So let's take a moment to just thank the players, men and women, footballers and hurlers, in anticipation of whose skills and dedication we have loaded up cars, made sandwiches and traversed the country. Míle buíochas Ó Shroí. You may indeed talk of Columbus a-sailing across the Atlantic Sea, but as I travelled West Clare on that sunny Sunday, there was no one as happy as me.
I wanted to tell you about visiting Monet's garden in Giverny. I wanted to mention the heart-stopping beauty of the cherry blossoms, all pink and white, the shimmer of bluebells at our feet, and everywhere apple and pear trees in full bloom. I wanted to mention Monet's house, the green shutters and pink stucco walls, exquisitely set amidst all this glory. I wanted to mention that Monet created his art twice, once in his garden and again in his paintings. And I also had to get in somewhere that the landlady of our small French bed and breakfast was an opera singer who sang for us on the morning of our departure. But mostly I wanted to write about the joy there is to be had in being with friends you've known all your life, friends who belong to that innermost intimate circle where nothing has to be explained. These friends know all about you, your family, your children, your siblings, your ex-husband. They even know the name of the dog you had when you were 10 years old. And best of all, and somewhat miraculously, despite knowing all this, they still want to hang around with you. The store of memories you've built up together over the years is the gold on which these friendships survive. The comfort there is to be had at the retelling of these memories, the good and the bad, the happy and the sad, cannot be measured. So, how to capture all this in one short piece? Well, back to Monet's garden. Giddy with the profusion of beauty all around us, we three friends stood among those cherry blossoms looking back at the Monet house. We noticed a small wooden platform or porch which led out from the front door. It was the kind of place you could sit in the evenings and watch the sun set behind the Japanese footbridge when the wisteria is in full bloom. The kind of place where the Monet family might gather with their friends on a blue-starred evening, sipping champagne. The kind of place where Mrs. Monet might step out from her chores in the kitchen to call out to her husband that the lunch was ready. Claude, viens, ton déjeuner est prêt. We imagined Claude Monet sitting by the lily pond at his easel, a paintbrush in one hand, calling back to her, oui, je viens bientôt. And then there was our landlady, the opera singer. Not understanding how precious an instrument is the human voice, we had boldly asked her to sing for us. I am not sure if "Ah, go on," entered the conversation, but knowing us, it probably did. But Madame had declined all our requests with a dismissive wave of her very French hand. But on the morning of our departure, she surprised us by saying, "Aujourd'hui, I will sing for you. I have prepared my voice." She put the palm of her hand flat against her diaphragm, took a deep breath, fixed her eyes on a far distant point, and began to sing Puccini's "O mio babbino caro." The tears still prick my eyes when I remember the majesty and power of that voice. It filled that small dining room and floated far over the fields to Monet's garden, over his Japanese footbridge, over the water lilies, and north towards Paris and the River Seine. We three Irish women were transfixed. Any time we got together after that, the conversation would eventually turn to Giverny and Madame Monet coming out to her porch to call, "Claude, viens, ton déjeuner est prêt." And then we dissolve into kinks of knee-bending laughter, driving mad, I'm sure, anybody who wasn't part of that Monet trip. And then, on cue, our eyes would mist over at the memory of our landlady singing Puccini's rapturous aria. And now, 30 years later, our little Giverny group of friends has been reduced by one. Now there are only two of us left who remember our imagined scene of Claude Monet and his wife. Now there are only two who, when we hear Puccini's aria, will be brought right back to a time when we were young and full of hope that friendships last forever. So what I am trying to say here in my long winding way through the north of France, through cherry blossom trees and Japanese footbridges, is this. Cling to those old friends. Cling to your glory days with them. Cling to those memories, because nothing lasts forever. And as John McGahern says in his memoir, All Will Be Well, the precious life is everything.
When I got booked to perform with the Stephen Frost Improv All-Stars at Glastonbury Festival in Somerset, it was a dream come true. I had one guest ticket, so I brought my son. We flew to Bristol on his 18th birthday, and he bought me a pint in the hostel that night. Next day, we got the bus to the festival, arriving on Thursday to a mucky mess. We trudged and slid through the soft earth, rutted by tractors and trucks, still setting up the main stages. With a large rucksack on my back, guitar in one hand, a bag in the other, damp boots on my feet, and the rest of me dripping with sweat, I joined the festival throng. Somehow everyone seemed to know where they were going. The place had the air of a makeshift prospector town, populated by a horde of glitter-sprinkled gold diggers. The mud reached right up to the makeshift vendors' cabins selling Wellingtons, rainproof ponchos, pink fun fur jackets and cowboy hats. Other vendors sold food from every part of the world, noodles, crepes, pasties and paella. I slipped and bumped into a squat, dreadlocked, tattooed native, spattering him with mud. "Oops, pardon me," he smiled. I smiled back wordlessly, not knowing how to react to such politeness. My heart did a somersault. I was 53, newly single and covered in mud, and this was my first Glastonbury festival. Glastonbury has history. The first festival, hosted by Michael Leavis, took place in 1970 for 1,500 people with T-Rex as the headline act. Now,